Welcome to She Talks Tech, the brand new podcast from We Are Tech Women.
We have, I think, 1.8 million CCTV cameras in London. And very recently in an area called King's Cross, we decided to apply facial recognition. And that became a huge scandal. This idea that we can invent our way to the future, I think we have to let go of. Because that future and that reality has had some really awful consequences.
I'm Vanessa Vallalee OBE, founder of We Are The City and We Are Tech Women. As an individual that's been a technologist both in the corporate space and as an entrepreneur, I know how tough it can be to rise to the top of our profession. Women in tech make up just 17% of the industry in the UK, and those stats do not improve even if you look overseas. At We Are Tech Women, we want you to rise to the top of the industry. We want you to sit into senior positions and be key decision makers. It gives me great pleasure to introduce this brand new podcast to the suite of support we are already offering to women in tech across the globe. The She Talks Tech podcast will bring you stories, lessons, and tips from some of the most inspirational women and men in the industry. From robotics and drones to fintechs, neurodiversity, and coronavirus apps, these individuals are sharing their experience for the benefit of your learning. In this episode of She Talks Tech from We Are Tech Women, we are hearing from Canadian-Italian author, consultant, public speaker and entrepreneur Alessandro Deschamps in her session about the Internet of Things. Alessandro co-founded Tinker London, which was the first UK distributor of Arduino, an open source electronic education platform. Alessandro's products are included in the permanent collection of the London Design Museum and the Museum of Modern Art in New York as examples of the Internet of Things. Alessandro was named as the top 100 influential tech women on Twitter and has been included in the long list of Computer Weekly's most influential women in tech in the UK. In this session, Alessandro discusses some of the lessons learned from a post-hype world of connected physical and digital experiences, and how ethics and security concerns have increased over the years. Alessandro also gives us the benefit of our experience in terms of what we could see in the future and how we could build jobs around these connected experiences.
I wanted to talk about late stage Internet of Things. We often hear about late stage capitalism, but I do think that there are connections to be made with what's happening in the Internet of Things since I started in 2007. I wanted to share some of those thoughts with you, as well as projects and people who I think are doing great work for today. Where did I start? I actually studied industrial design and interaction design, and I moved to this country and started distributing the Arduino. If you're not familiar with it, the Arduino is an open source hardware educational platform, so anybody can learn how to play with electronics. And at the time in 2015, I was the first UK distributor. I also built a business called Tinker, where we used the platform to offer services and we ran public and private workshops. And at the time, I think the Arduino was really an important step in building what became the maker community, but also building a sense of awareness of electronics, that electronics were not only hidden away in the computers around you, but they were things that could be malleable and creative and open and easy to access and easy to learn. And I think at the time, because it was so cheap and because it was open source, it really made a dent in some people's thinking around what they could do professionally, but also educationally, and how they could develop either a career or some knowledge around this space. I also think it's important to remember that this was a European project. So I think it's very easy when you work in technology to think that everything comes from the US somehow. The Arduino was at the time manufactured in Italy, and it still remains to this day a mostly European and international now based project. But the fact that it was made in Italy made the dynamic around how it was promoted and who promoted it actually very different. This was a tool that you were more likely to hear about if you were a master's degree student in design. And putting a tool like this in the hands of people who had no engineering background, who had very little technical literacy, I think is still fundamentally quite new. I'm not sure we know how to do that in any other context in the same way. As part of building Tinker, I also, you know, got to build a team around me who were using the Arduino and other tools to develop solutions and develop products and develop offerings that were creative. They were creative in nature. They were, some of them one-off, some of them part of research projects, some of them were kind of art projects, some of them were deployed in a multiplicity and internationally. And for someone like me to have the capability of exploring the world of product design, the world of connected experiences, I think was really incredibly important in the early years of my career. At the time, I was between the ages of 27 to 31. I had very little technical literacy, but I was hanging out with a lot of developers and a lot of hardware engineers, and that really made a huge difference to my literacy levels. I became sort of the founder of the Goodnight Lamp, which eventually was made in 2015 and shipped internationally and is now part of the permanent collection of the London Design Museum. And HomeSense was a project around bottom-up smart homes and what that could be. And that is in the collection, the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art. To be able to work on those kinds of projects at the time and for them to end up having some kind of cultural impact, I think is very unique of the time in that space. The peer group around me was fairly limited. I had just started running the Internet of Things meetup in 2011, and it was a time of experimentation where people who, yes, maybe were technically minded, but also were very creative, were picking up these tools like the Arduino and making things. Small batches of products, hundreds, maybe thousands. There were no real investors. You would really struggle to find someone who at the time in 2011, 2012 was making, you know, millions of units of something that was connected because people were still experimenting. That was an incredibly creative time to be in the sector. It meant that you could graduate from a design college and put something together and find very rapidly in the UK, in London, a community of practitioners who would rally behind you, support you, help you find co-founders or technical co-founders. All you needed was a really good idea and some creative sensibility, aesthetic sensibility, a sense of what would work or not. In the last 2-3 years now, I've transitioned away from kind of being 100% into making products and more into systems and history. I'm very interested in the historical context around the products that we're developing today. So I wrote a book 2 years ago called Smarter Homes, and it breaks down the history of technology in the home space. I'm speaking to you from my living room. You might be hearing the dog that lives downstairs. Our homes, and in the early stages of the Internet of Things, a consumer offering was incredibly important to get this community and this industry off the ground. When people know what a connected experience means for them in their everyday life, then they can push it into their work life. If we look at mobile phones and how the appetite for the iPhone sort of pushed everyone to use their iPhone at work, that's a good example. The idea that you would have electricity in your home space also made, you know, electrical appliances sort of easier to imagine in other contexts. And the fact that we have connected thermostats today mean that we can then accept connected buildings in our workplaces. So the role of the home, I think, has really been keen. I've really enjoyed researching that. I also worked as head of labs at Bulb, an energy company, and I've continued to do work around the energy sector because understanding what makes a connected experience tick is also understanding what that connected experience relies on, which is an entire infrastructure that is currently being very much under stress. And through all of this combined experience, I have some thoughts I wanted to share with you. Firstly, I think that the work that I've done over the last few years has moved me from seeing a lot of very new things to seeing a lot of repetition and what you might call the beginning of laggards and the beginning of people who probably should have been experimenting internally a little while ago and are just starting now. And I think that that's been very interesting. It's been very interesting to see either in my own work, but also in my peer group. The people who start in a sector are not necessarily the people who help make it mature. And I think we're all comfortable with that concept. But I do think it has an impact in the Internet of Things when we think of a future vision for the sector. The fact that we might lose the innovators, maybe at the stage of early majority, maybe at the kind of late majority stage, because they've moved on. They've moved on to innovate elsewhere, or they've decided that they've learned everything they needed to learn and have moved on to other sectors. It's, you know, a community of people who are really important. And I have seen them move away from either working in the Internet of Things and move away for a number of different reasons. Some of it is related to their own successes or failures. Some of it is life stage. This is a community that I have polled in the UK for many years, and it's an older community. It's a community of people between the ages of 35 to 55. These are not necessarily very young people. A very young person isn't today necessarily looking at the Internet of Things as a future career prospect. And I think that's something to consider, something to think about when we talk about STEM and education, we talk about all these things. We also don't necessarily make it very clear where you can find jobs, but also that you might need to invent your own job. I think that discussion around entrepreneurship in the Internet of Things is still missing. We also, I think, have a really political landscape when it comes to defining the Internet of Things. This image is an image I created in 2012, where I thought, you know, people are using this word and they don't know what they mean. They're using it to kind of describe anything. And I like coming back to it because I feel like that was very naive of me. It was very naive of me to think that anybody cared about what was the correct use of the word IoT, because we can see now that people will appropriate the term to mean just about anything under the sun, whether it's proprietary systems, whether it's proprietary hardware, whether it's got nothing to do with any internet at all, or it's got nothing to do with any hardware at all, and it's a piece of middleware. It kind of doesn't matter. People have embraced the term as being open and general and welcoming. And I think that's maybe the point. It also means that a lot of obfuscation also happens. A lot of trend setting happens as well. People use IoT the same way that some people might use AI, when really what they mean is there's a piece of connected hardware and I'm using a computer. People use machine learning in kind of the same way sometimes. They mean is automated decision making, but it sounds cooler to say machine learning. So I think that IoT also has suffered from it, maybe, but perhaps it's made people want to embrace it professionally a little bit more because it has sounded trendy. I do think there is a downward trend to how trendy this topic is. Too many trends. And I do think that people are now looking to, you know, what the next thing is, because this kind of feels like, oh, well, we've been talking about this for 20 years. And it has almost been 20 years since Kevin Ashton coined the term. So I think with that comes a whole lot of other things. One which is now, of course, with the maturity of the sector, you will find people have created businesses and offerings everywhere, from education to not even necessarily commercialization, but putting things up on Kickstarter. There's a commodification of the sector from a hardware perspective. People feel that there is enough appetite because enough platforms exist and enough offerings exist to try their luck and build their own. I think it's incredibly competitive. It's incredibly difficult to actually compete with the more established players. Intel's Galileo is a very nice example of a platform that wasn't quite able to compete. I think that it's very difficult to make a space for a completely new piece of educational hardware on the market. I do think there's something interesting there, which is also to say that it's not that everything that's there already is doing a job. It's just the job of selling to the education market or the DIY market or perhaps the very advanced engineer is probably a little saturated. And so perhaps the potential for this space isn't necessarily for those markets. And with that access that people now have to hardware, I think it's also very easy to bundle things up in ways that to me seem quite interesting. I mean, interesting in the British sense of interesting. So this is a smart city starter kit that I found advertised on LinkedIn the other day. And I find this interesting because this is a collection of sensors. It's a collection of software capabilities as well as hardware capabilities, and it uses LoRaWAN. But this kind of does require a city. It does require a city stakeholder. It does require someone who wants to install, maintain these, be responsible for the results it may find, be responsible for changing parking policies if something is found. So all of the human capital and the human dependencies are not something you can buy off the shelf. And so the fact that you can buy a kit doesn't necessarily mean that you will be able to implement this set of tools in a way that will work for your city. You have to be both in political situation to be interested in it and an economic situation that the city can afford this and can afford this at scale. I've seen a lot of projects that could not find these conditions. They found that the hardware was actually the least of their problems. Their problems were in getting everyone to get on board behind the results that could be generated by these tools. And the fact that that is not necessarily a part of the offering here, yes, there's managed network and warranty and technical support, but there isn't really lobbying support. There isn't necessarily education that comes with this, where perhaps some of the counselors in any city in the world might need to be told how these things work so that when someone points to the box stuck up on a pole somewhere, they don't go, is that Big Brother? And that educational piece isn't there yet. It doesn't come with a smart city starter kit. And I live in a city where that is incredibly plain, that we tend to sometimes put the tech first and hope to death no one notices. We have, I think, 1.8 million CCTV cameras in London. And very recently in an area called King's Cross, we decided to apply facial recognition alongside those cameras. And that became a huge scandal. For some of you living elsewhere around the world, this might be, you know, small potatoes compared to what you have locally. But in our economic environment, political environment last year, which is when this scandal erupted, this was a big deal. And the area and the landowner, because it's private land ultimately, the landowner had to decide to take down this implementation. I find this interesting because it is very much about the political and social conditions around a technology. And I think that IoT has had the luxury of not having to deal with these conditions until it got quite big, quite known, and inside people's homes and lives. A best example of this are the services that we buy when we buy a piece of hardware. I wrote a lot about this in my book, but I think that when we buy a piece of assistive hardware, whether it's a smart speaker or something else, we're also buying an invisible service. We're buying services by people who may or may not be very well paid, who may or may not be in economic situations that are fair or economic and work conditions that are fair. But we're just told that we're buying a piece of connected hardware. We're not told that we're buying an entire ecosystem of inequality. And I think that's something that we're extremely sensitive about now because of COVID. We also, in a kind of late stage Internet of Things kind of way, have governments now starting to get involved, sometimes in productive ways, sometimes in sort of 10 years too late kind of ways. But it's good, I think. In the UK, the Department for Culture, Media and Sport, DCMS, is in the process of defining what a minimum provision of support should be for a connected product to ensure that it is secure. And this is something that, as part of the IoT meetup, the community has been talking about for many years, and it relates to whether there is such a thing as a certification for IoT. The community came to the conclusion that there really isn't a really good way to generalize to such a degree about connected experiences. The UK government apparently does not follow our line of thinking, and maybe it'll be good for some things. But I'm following this as sort of a late stage element, because when governments get involved and start regulating, you know that things have happened that have made them worry. So 2 years ago, for example, that same department produced a trust by design framework. A few years before that, some more public consultancies. And this is because security in some IoT deployments has been less than stellar. It's very easy to accuse the sector of not doing enough. I think it's incredibly hard to make a connected product. It's incredibly hard to have access to secure security professionals that are willing to help smaller companies. And because those services are so expensive, then companies go with what they know. And sometimes what they know isn't the best. And so consumers suffer. And all of these dynamics are very much part of a late stage series of learnings that as an industry, we have to go through. We have to go through the hard work of what it takes when you're deploying things that are connected in people's homes. And I do think that we have to stop snacking on invention as a sort of a way of justifying really poor decision making. And it's not only about security. This is about design. This is about investment. This is about an investment landscape that is just bizarre sometimes. Now, in sort of a later stage, I actually revisited some of what I had found in 2015. And so this is a egg holder for your fridge that tells you when the eggs are about to go off. And it was meant to cost $70. Surprise, surprise, it didn't particularly go well public commercially. This was funded by a platform for ideas called Quirky, and eventually the product was canned. And this is after a huge amount of investment in that particular product. And I think those 2015 kind of stories are kind of still with us. There's still some things that just don't make any sense, but the enthusiasm of the founder, the enthusiasm of the investment firm will get that product into a market. I also compared 2015 most funded products on Kickstarter to today. And unfortunately, I find that we haven't really moved on from those very early pioneers, let's put it, of connected product experiences. Pebble is a company that no longer exists. The Coolest Cooler was kind of a catastrophe in terms of manufacturing. And it's still today, they are the two highest funded products on Kickstarter, right before some games, which I think crowdfunding is kind of really good for. This idea that we can invent our way to the future, I think we have to let go of, because that future and that reality has had some really awful consequences. This is also an old PwC report that showed that most people who had bought a wearable had within a year stopped using it entirely. And I think that the data that we could get today is probably very similar. This is hand in hand with fast fashion and the world of fast fashion, which you could say wearables are partly part of, we have developed an information ecosystem and a social ecosystem where wearing the same thing twice gets you in trouble. So imagine having a connected product with you for a very long time. I think this particular issue will have an effect on what we want to design for COVID, for example. If we think that some of the technologies that might help us in the near future are wearable, we have to be aware that people might not want to have these products for very long in their lives. And more broadly speaking, I think we now have a conversation with ourselves that's very much about what we are doing to the planet. Cisco's 50 billion devices, well, I certainly hope they're not correct in their assumptions, because that means that probably most of them will be in landfill somewhere. There's a fantastic project called the Restart Project in London, which looks at issues around design for repairability, which is part of the European Union's new laws. I think that some governments, and certainly the UK isn't a particularly good example, have been good at making sure that we have options as consumers. So we can buy connected products, but then what do we do with them if we decide not to have them anymore? We don't have a huge amount of options in the UK. In the US, in New York, for example, they have something called eCycle, where you can get free pickup of any electronic waste if you're more than 10 inhabitants in a building or 10 flats. We don't really have that here. We have communal recycling centers, and it's largely up to individuals and not up to the councils whose budgets are constantly cut. And we have, I think, a responsibility as designers. This is Safia Qureshi, was just interviewed this week by Dezeen and talks about the responsibility of a designer. And that if you're not designing for disassembly or recycling, you're a bad designer. I think that's a really powerful statement. And I would hope that the designers working in businesses that refuse to consider these things can also say, this is a bad business. This is a business not interested in educating its own clients as to what recycling and recyclability means. And we're still, some 11 years later, living in a world where we can create the sensors we want for the world we want. So they're now called defeat devices, I learned this morning. But we can essentially trick ourselves and our planet into polluting continuously on a variety of different cars, never mind just VW. So I think that we have a lot of late stage problems with this sector. And these are problems that we can't just avoid. It's a bit like COVID. You can't just say, well, we'll just cordon off a bunch of people somewhere and put them in a bubble. There is no bubble. And the ideals that we developed post-Second World War are no longer there to help us. They're no longer useful. We have to create new ideals, and out of that come new ideas. And new ideas of what connected experiences can mean for us in the future. And maybe they're not about us. Maybe they're not about the Dick Tracy watch. Maybe they're about our environment and monitoring more specifically how our environment is doing and what we contribute to it. I'll leave you with three companies that I really like, because I think it's always good to think about these late stage ideas in terms of opportunity spaces and in terms of investment spaces for you if you're looking at the sector and looking to invest in the sector. One is called FieldKit. It's one of many companies looking at conservation practices and looking at environmental monitoring, making that more accessible, cheaper, more fun, so that we have a better understanding of what happens in people's environments at a very micro level, not just at a weather station level. Companies are also looking at how to green the technology that makes all of this work. So it's all very good to have sensors in your field. If they're still being powered by coal, it's not so great. So Climate Action Tech is a group online looking at how to green at least part of the internet, making sure that servers are mostly powered with renewables. and they've got a really great network that's growing continuously. And finally, a company in London called Provenance, they've been looking at supply chains and how you can really guarantee that a supply chain is doing the right thing. And part of that is using some technology. Part of that is just, you know, great business practices and making sure those are documented. But I think these start to address some of our late stage problems. They're about taking responsibility for the actions of invention and creativity, because invention and creativity can happen after you've also made some pretty poor choices. I think we still and we'll continue to need all the help we can get and all the creativity we can get. And I hope that no matter where you are in your sector, in your life, that you continue to be creative around some of these big problems and these late stage problems that we're having.
Alessandro, I cannot thank you enough for being my guest on this episode of She Talks Tech. I, for one, learned so much from listening to this session. A huge thank you to all of our guests today for tuning in and listening. We really appreciate your support. You can find out more about Alessandro by visiting tinkerlondon.com, or you can follow her on Twitter on IoT Watch. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, we'd really appreciate it if you would subscribe. That way you get notifications of our upcoming episodes. If you enjoy what you hear, please rate the podcast and give us a 5-star review. We look forward to welcoming you next week on Wednesday for a brand new episode of She Talks Tech from We Are Tech Women.